if you do have questions about the dwelling, I'll be happy to talk about it. The risk of further dwelling.
I have one question.
Yes?
I have a question.
Professor Finnegan. Do I have to be looking at you as you're asking me?
No, I'm looking at you. So you started off last time by saying there's no local observable gravity.
Yes.
Motivation. And so that leads you to focus on trying to identify the correct boundary observable.
Right. Of your program.
But I guess...
Well, it's not, I mean, that part of the program is trivial here. It's just
right.
The S matrix.
Right, right.
It's non-trivial in other situations.
So the question I have is... So what happens if the universe is spatially compact?
Right. Well, I think we're screwed. I mean, it's a really... I mean, those are the really excellent questions.
So is this like an argument that the universe is not spatially compact?
Naively, there's nothing. Exactly. So, I mean, this is really, you know, when... as you know, people like to confuse themselves about quantum mechanics a lot.
Right.
There's nothing to be confused about until you say the word cosmology.
Right.
And in particular, closed universe is, I think, the most confusing thing of all. Because in a closed universe, you can't separate apparatuses arbitrarily, you can't make them arbitrarily big. Both infinities are removed. And not even in a subtle way, like they are in eternal inflation, just in an in-your-face way.
Right.
So I think it's just trouble.
Right.
It's just trouble.
Wait,
and I think what quantum observables are in a closed universe, they don't seem to exist. None seem to exist. Now, I mean, this is why I said I think that the whole class of questions are the most important, are the hardest conceptual problems that we have today. There's two attitudes. Depending on your temperament, you might think of the attitudes as radical or reactionary. Okay, the reactionary attitude is say, good, we need quantum observables. Therefore, closed universes don't exist. We don't actually have solutions and fundamental theories, blah, 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 which give us completely closed universes. That's one attitude. That's I think, the extreme quantum mechanical attitude, right? By the way, that extreme quantum mechanical attitude has worked so far, all the time.
Right.
However, it worked for, in every situation where like in the black hole information problem, quantum mechanics held, no problem. But of course, it was a situation where quantum mechanics could hold. I mean, there was an observable there after all. There was the S matrix. It didn't. It wasn't predicting its own demise. Okay, in this situation, I'm giving a long answer because I have no idea. So it's possible they just don't exist. I mean, and that's the attitude you can really push. Like in the inside of ABS space, they just don't exist, and it's true. You know, the observables live on the boundary, that's great. There's a boundary theory, perfect. The problem is, as we push this attitude further and further, we run into fewer and fewer things to talk about. There's imaginary situations like closed universes, there's our own inflating universe, and at some point you seem to be left with nothing. And then it's a real question, what do you do at that point? Perhaps quantum mechanics isn't quite right. Or if not quite right, it has to be
reinterpreted
in some very, very significant way. It is a strange feature about quantum mechanics that it needs this separation of the universe into two pieces, infinite and not, in order to make any prediction. It's just true. There's a reason why Lorentz and his classical friends were so bothered by all of this after all.
I'm a little confused. If I have a compact universe and I just have a small little piece of it,
yep.
Then presumably what happens locally is in some sense decoupled from what happens very, very far away.
No one is arguing that there aren't approximate observables. Of course there are approximate observables. And this is why, as I said, when you get on your high theorist course and tell the experimentalists there's no local observables, the people who just won the Nobel Prize this afternoon will say, well, I got a Nobel Prize for my non-observable.
So you quantify the
problem is, the problem is that because of gravity, there is no way, as I said yesterday, it's a very standard argument, there's no way any experiment can be done that would send the systematic error on that thing to zero. The reason that struck A is just a fact. It's just an observational fact about the world. An empirical fact. Well, no one has done the experiment so many times. In fact, we're extrapolating.
Right.
But we imagine if we do the experiment that many times, it wouldn't converge to a sharp answer. That's A. But B, the other reason it's troubling is that, let's say you have a theory. Okay? Let's say I have a theory of quantum gravity. Great. So there's a bunch of equations, a bunch of numbers come out. Right? What do those numbers mean? Before you talk about the theory, you have to talk about what the theory is supposed to predict. It's a much more basic thing than having a theory. This is why the people who talk about very naive approaches to quantizing gravity, like Loop-loop quantum gravity, are totally, completely as misguided as they can possibly be. Because what do they talk about? They talk about discrete areas, all. This is just nonsense. There's no such thing. I mean, there's no experiment that's going to measure anything to the requisite precision that can even tell you if an area was discrete or not. If someone comes up to you and says, I have a theory of quantum gravity, and here are its local observables, you say, thank you very much. I won't pay any attention to your theory. It doesn't make any sense. Okay? There aren't any. There's no actual observables that correspond to it. Now, the problem is that we can't be too high and mighty about this because we start running out of things to talk about in this attitude about the world. Okay, like I said yesterday, thank you so much. We're talking trash about you the whole time.
So. It's all in there.
Yeah, it's true. I'll have to have a conversation with that gentleman. The problem, I mean, if you want a really, really hard problem to work on that one. It's way harder than any of the things that I'm talking about here. It's just that, at least I have the sense that these problems are too hard, and that we have to first come to grips with some simpler things before attacking them. You know, there are time and problems that get solved when it's time for them to be solved. There people like to make this analogy, it's a very good one. In the early 1900s, there were a whole bunch of things that you could be confused about. Black body radiation, radioactivity, superconductivity, okay? Very bad idea to work on superconductivity, okay? Not because, and in the end, it wasn't even a more fundamental problem than the other ones. It's just that many, many other things needed to be understood before we attacked that one. So you work on, you follow your nose, you work on the next hardest problem you can, which you can hope to make some progress on. That's the okay, enough philosophy. So we are interested in a Yang-Mills theory computing what I called yesterday the color strip scattering amplitude. Okay, so the actual scattering amplitude has a bunch of color indices on it, A1 up to AN, but we can take every possible color structure that appears as a trace of a product of T, A1 up to TAN, with various permutations of those indices. And the coefficient of each one of them is some object, okay? Some permutation of M1, 2, up to N. So we're just going to be interested in one of these things. It's called the color strip, the color strip scattering. Okay? And it also depends, in the general theory, on the velocities of the particles and the momenta, okay? So P1, P2, up to Pn. Okay, our first task is to find the right set of variables to discuss these scattering amplitudes. And when I mean the right set, I mean a set where you finally see what they're actually functions of, rather than these redundant representations in terms of polarization vectors and momentum that we talked about. So in other words, we're after finding objects, unlike polarization vectors, which don't exist, which when you do a Lorentz transformation on them, transform as some Lorentz tensor on one side, but pick up the little group phase transformation on the other side. Okay? This is a perfectly well-defined mathematical question. You would think the answer would be in Weinberg Volume 1, Chapter 1, Paragraph 1, and it isn't. Okay? It should be, it could be, but actually no one has worked it out in general. We fortunately have a very simple answer in 4 dimensions. It's been worked out last year in 6 dimensions. There's probably a very simple story in any number of dimensions, but it isn't in the literature yet. So if you want a very nice problem to work on, generalizing at any number of dimensions would allow all of this progress in amplitude to start being ported to a higher dimension. There's actually a nice paper yesterday by Zvi Byrne and friends that started using the 6-dimensional formalism to do the same kinds of gains in 6 dimensions. But anyway. But we live in 4 dimensions, let's introduce the variables. So the idea is, I'm going to work with the Weyl-Spinner representation of everything. So in particular, a 4 vector I can represent as a 2x2 matrix P alpha alpha dot, which is just sigma mu P mu alpha alpha dot. So if you remember, this is the matrix that's P0 plus P3, P0 minus P3, P1 plus IP2, P1 minus IP2. And the determinant of this matrix, P, is just equal to P nu, P nu. That was the point. That's equal to P squared. And the Lorentz group is SL2C, is the Lorentz group. Now, let's say we have a massless particle, so the determinant of P is 0. So P squared is 0, so the determinant of P is 0. Okay. That means that P, it's a 2x2 matrix whose determinant is 0. Either both of its eigenvalues are 0, in which case it's 0, or one of its eigenvalues is 0. So that's the generic case where one of its eigenvalues is 0. That means that it's a rank 1 matrix. Because one of its eigenvalues is 0, that means that I can write this 2x2 matrix as some vector times another vector. It's rank 1. Okay? So we'll do that. We'll write P alpha alpha dot as lambda alpha lambda tilde alpha dot. Okay? So I mean, very, very concretely, if we had something moving in the z direction, right, then P would be like 2, 0, 0, 0. That would be the matrix. So lambda could be root 2, 0, lambda tilde could be root 2, 0, okay? So I'm just writing P equals lambda tilde. Now, for real momenta, P alpha alpha dot has got to be a Hermitian matrix, right? It's Hermitian there. So that means that real momenta for real momenta, lambda tilde is actually lambda star, right? It's actually its complex conjugate. A very big part of this whole story is that reality is not very important. Okay? In fact, we're going to complexify everything inside. Everything is going to be complex. We're going to be writing down integrals. Everything's going to be a contour integral. Everything is holomorphic. Everything is complex all the time. Okay? So just remember that that's what reality is. That's what the reality condition is. But we're going to consider general lambda alpha and lambda tilde alpha dot general and unrelated. Okay. So what we're really doing is just talking about general complexified momentum. Okay. And on these and writing these light-like vectors. So these vectors are always light-like. But now, if lambda tilde is not equal to lambda, the momentum will in general be complex. Okay. Furthermore, on this complexified space, the Lorentz group isn't SL2C, it's SL2C cross SL2C. Okay. There's two SL2s that act on the lambda and the lambda tilde. Okay. So the Lorentz group, the complexified Lorentz group is bigger. It's SL2C cross SL2C. And since everything is complex all over the place, I'll be dropping the C's all the time. So the Lorentz group is SL2 cross SL2. One SL2 acting on the lambdas, the other SL2 acting on the lambda tildes. Okay? The diagonal part of that is the real Lorentz group when you identify lambda tilde to be lambda star, which is still a complex group, but still SL2C. The diagonal SL2C is the product of these two SL2s. Sometimes it'll be useful to... And this is largely for intuition purposes, and for doing some explicit computations. It's useful to imagine that lambda and lambda tilde are independent, but independent and real, both of them real. Okay. Lambda and lambda tilde, independent and both real, actually corresponds to doing physics in 2, 2 signature. Okay. So imagine we are doing things in 2, 2 signature, not 3, 1 signature. Let's say we're doing things in 2, 2 signature. Then it would be useful for us to group a 4 vector into P0 plus P3, P0 minus P3, P1 plus P2, no I's, P1 minus P2. This is otherwise known as a completely general 2x2 real matrix. Okay? A totally general 2x2 real matrix, but notice that its determinant is P0 squared minus P3 squared minus P1 squared plus P2 squared. Okay, so it looks like 2, 2 signature, 2 pluses and 2 minuses. Okay? So if we think of lambda and lambda tilde as being independent and real, then what we're doing is describing a null momentum vector in 2, 2 signature. Okay? So that's just one particular case. We will sometimes do this, especially when we talk about going to a twister space, which involves doing various Fourier transforms relative to these guys, just so we can think naively about doing Fourier transforms over real variables. We'll imagine that we're doing things in 2, 2 signature. Very often, it just doesn't matter what signature you're doing anything in. You just take care of going back the 3, 1 signature at the very, very, very end of the calculation. Okay, so the signature, everything is going to be floating around constantly. Everything is going to be complex. Okay.
So in general, the lambdas are all complex or whatever they want.
Now, in general, lambdas are complex, lambda tilde is complex, they're totally independent variables. I've just given you 2 interesting slices. One of them is lambda tilde equals lambda star, both complex, but one the complex conjugate of the other. That's 3, 1 signature, real momenta and 3, 1 signature. The other one is lambda real, lambda tilde real and independent, and that corresponds to null momenta in 2, 1. Okay? Very good. Now, notice something wonderful about this, which is that the lambdas and the lambda tildes are actually not uniquely associated to a given p. Okay? I can rescale lambda by something and lambda tilde by its opposite, and it leaves p invariant. Let's say for the moment we go back to 3, 1 signature. So the rescaling that we're talking about, if it's going to keep lambda and lambda tilde complex conjugates of each other, would be to send lambda to e to the I some e to the I theta lambda, and lambda tilde goes to e to the negative I theta lambda tilde. Okay? So the lambdas and lambda tildes are not uniquely associated to a given p. That's obvious just from counting. Okay? There are 3 independent components of a null momentum, 4 in general, and 1 that forces the energy to equal the magnitude of the momentum. So there's 3 parameters. Okay? There are 2, the lambda has is a 2-complex dimensional vector, so it has 4 parameters. We're forcing lambda tilde to be the complex conjugate of lambda. Okay, so there's still 4 parameters. We haven't added any new ones, but there's 4 there, not 3. And the fact that there's 4 is reflected in this rephase invariance. Okay, I can rephase lambda by any phase, do the opposite to lambda tilde, and I have the same p. This should remind you of something. What else is there that keeps a null momentum invariant but rephases? That's what the little group does. That's exactly what the little group does. Okay? So in fact, that freedom on these guys is precisely the action of the little group. Exactly the action of the little group.
The you can see, one?
Huh? Yeah, I mean just it just
one.
Yes, because that's all that leaves p invariant. Okay? You can actually go through a whole argument if you want to do this more carefully. Let me just sketch it. Just to make it look identical to the little group. It actually literally is the little group. What you can do, just like you're used to in discussions of the little group, is you can say, let me pick some canonical k null vector, and for that canonical k, let me pick some canonical way of writing it as lambda times lambda tilde. This is my choice, okay? Let's put stars there. This is my choice. I'm going to pick of all the possible ways I can write it that way. I'm going to pick one way of doing it. Great, okay? And then I'm going to define, if I define P to be some Lorentz transformation acting on K, I'm going to define the lambda, so this is the lambda, so let me, this is the lambda for K, which is my choice. I choose whatever I want. But I'm going to define the lambda for P to just be the L alpha beta, lambda beta acting on the lambda for K. Okay? So this is exactly, so if, I take a reference null vector, I write a general momentum as some Lorentz transformation on the null vector, and I just define the lambda for these other vectors to be that Lorentz transformation in its SL2 representation acting on lambda. So now I'm done. I've defined canonically a lambda and a lambda tilde with every null momentum in the world. Okay? That's fine, but what's not true is that if I now do some Lorentz transformation on P, this is not equal to lambda alpha beta, lambda beta on P. Okay? Instead, it's equal to that up to a phase. And that action of the phase is exactly the little group action for the spin a half representation. Okay. So these are the objects we're looking for. Under Lorentz transformations, they transform like a nice spinner, and they pick up a phase. Okay. So that means that if I were to build, so what kind of Lorentz invariants could I build out of these objects? The sorts of Lorentz invariants I can build are just contracting the lambdas and the lambda tildes with the epsilon symbol, just as we're used to all the time. So just as a notation, if you have a lambda 1 and a lambda 2, that angle bracket refers to contracting them with the epsilon symbol. And this I will also sometimes write this as just 1, 2, when there's no confusion. Similarly, lambda tilde 1, lambda tilde 2 refers to contracting them is 1, 2. But you see, these objects are Lorentz invariants, but they have little group transformation properties. Okay? This object under Lorentz transformations picks up a phase as if we were talking about a negative velocity particle by convention. Negative velocity particle for 1 of spin a half, and negative velocity of spin a half for 2. This would be positive spin a half for 1, positive spin a half for 2. Okay? This makes it amazingly easy to write down objects that deserve, at least from the transformation properties, to be called scattering amplitudes. Okay. Let's give a simple example. So let's say we have 1, 3 to the 4th divided by 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 1. Okay. This is happens to be the Park-Taylor amplitude for 2 gluons of negative velocity, and 1 and 3, and 2 gluons of positive velocity, 2 and 4, but let's see how we would discover that. Okay? Well, you just look at it, and you see that under rescaling 1, by the way, in 3-1 signature is rephasing, but in general, it's a completely general complex. Lambda goes to T lambda, lambda tilde goes to T inverse lambda tilde. Okay? So you see, this object picks up 4 powers upstairs and 2 downstairs, so it goes like T squared under rescaling 1. Okay? So that's like twice velocity negative a half, so velocity negative 1. So particle 1, this amplitude, the fact that it's not home, it has some weight under rescaling lambda 1, and its weight just gives you the velocity of the particle. That's all. Okay? So the scattering amplitudes are homogeneous functions of these invariant brackets, and their homogeneity tells you what the velocity is.
Anyway, so they're not invariant. I'm confused. They're not invariant under this rescaling.
Definitely not. Amplitudes are not invariant under Lorentz transformations. They're not invariant. They pick up a little group action on the external particles that tells you what velocities they have. So they better not be invariant. Okay? And they're not invariant. Okay? That's how you tell. That's the difference between this being gluons and some other amplitude that would just be for scalars. Okay. So particles 1 and 3 are velocity negative 1. Particles 2 and 4 are velocity plus 1.
Sorry, I'm confused. Yeah. Very, very simple question, but confused what you say that the amplitude is not invariant under. But I would think the little group is like the U1 electromagnetism. That's what I have.
No, it is not like me. Well, I mean, it's a U1, but it's like saying for rotations, the spin a half particle is not invariant under rotations. Okay. It rotates.
Okay.
It transforms into some representation. Yeah.
What did you mean when you said that these bracket 1-2s are Lorentz invariants in some way? Is there...
No. I've completely contracted all the Lorentz indices. So under the Lorentz transformations, they're invariant. But they pick up...
Up to
the phase, which is the little group, right? You see, and that's because of this fact. Once you define them once and for all in some way, then Lorentz transforming, Lorentz transforming their corresponding momenta doesn't just take them back to the ordinary, to the Lorentz transforming momenta. There's a phase. This is exactly what happens with the little group argument. If there's grad students here who haven't gone through this, this you really should go through. This is in Weinberg, Volume 1, Chapter 1, Paragraph 2. Okay, but this is very important. This is what particles are, right? The particles are just defined by how they transform under the Lorentz group and the fact that they pick up these auxiliary transformation properties under the little group. Okay, but the point is that using these variables is incredibly simple to keep track of that now. Okay, in a way that was not possible with polarization vectors. And this is why, as I said, you've never seen this kind of formula in a standard class, and that's why you've never seen an actual scattering amplitude. Here we're actually staring at the object itself. Okay? That's what it really is. It's really a function of these variables in a non-redundant way. Yes? Right.
Can you guys read why 1 and 3, 1 is D and 2 and 4 are the other from this formula?
Yes, yes, great. So let me say a general statement first. If you have an amplitude that depends on a bunch of lambdas, I'll always use a convention where A runs from 1 to n is the number of particles. Okay. This has to have the property that if you rescale like so, it's equal to pa to the power of negative 2 ha m of lambda tilde. In other words, it's separately homogeneous under rescaling every one of the particles. It's not some overall thing. You take any one of the particles, you rescale lambda and lambda tilde, it has to have a particular way. Okay? And also, if someone goes and gives you this formula and adds another term, let's say they added a term with some square bracket, 1, 3 to the fourth upstairs, then it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't have a well-defined homogeneity. Okay? All the terms, everything has to have a well-defined homogeneity. So this is what scattering amplitudes are. Okay? Just group theoretically, it's very simple. You build them out of lambdas and lambda tildes, out of the Lorentz invariant inner products that you can build out of them, but they have to have particular homogeneity. Okay. Any questions about this so far? All right, so now I'm going to, let me write that back up again here. So let's begin our discussion of scattering amplitudes by talking about the most basic scattering amplitude, which is a three-particle amplitude. This is one of the things that, you know, when you first learn a new subject, you tend to become obsessed with some things that are just awesome and are really simple but totally awesome. This is one of the really simple but totally awesome things, because it actually goes to the heart of what's so powerful about this way of thinking about things. You see, we normally don't ever write down the three-particle amplitude because it normally doesn't exist. Quantum field theory books don't tend to begin by talking about, let's consider the three-particle amplitude for a gluon 1 goes to 2 gluons, because there's no phase space for it to happen. The amplitude vanishes. Okay? In a real signature, for real momenta, the three-particle amplitude vanishes. However, that just turns out to be a complete accident of real momenta in 3-1 signature. It doesn't even vanish in 2,2 signature. It's just a real accident of 3-1 signature. An accident that sort of, well, that if you like, delays progress for a long time until you realize it.
Yeah. The amplitude vanishes.
The amplitude itself vanishes.
The amplitude phase.
The phase space also vanishes. The amplitude itself vanishes. The amplitude itself straight up. In fact, it would be very disturbing if the amplitude did not vanish. Okay? Precisely because,
The phase space, they don't let you A go to 2A.
Right, but the actual physical amplitude vanishes, right? Physical amplitude just vanishes. If you just plug in, you plug in the vertex and Yang mills or something. Of course, I'm talking about it vanishes in Yang mills. It doesn't vanish. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't vanish in pi cube theory. It doesn't vanish. Okay, but it actually vanishes in Yang mills.
Because of the elliptic, because you cannot.
Yep. But anyway, it doesn't matter because it doesn't actually vanish. So let's actually write it down. Okay. Just to show, I mean, we'll do it more systematically in a second, but just so you see very, very explicitly, what I want to do here. I wanted to just, let's see. Three nice generic momenta that sum to zero, that conserve momentum, and they're all on shell. Okay. They're all on shell, but this last one is on shell because there is an I there. Okay. So 1 squared plus I squared is equal to zero. So for generic, there are whole sets of three momenta that are complex, which allow this process to be on shell. Okay. Well, let's actually look at what the statement of conservation of momentum is for three particles more carefully. Okay. So it's lambda 1 tilde, plus lambda 2 tilde, plus lambda 3 tilde, is equal to zero. Yes, three particles. Okay. Now, there's a very important general fact that's surprisingly useful in this business over and over again, which is that it's possible to take a two-dimensional vector and expand it in the basis of any other two-dimensional vectors. Okay? That very basic fact we're going to use again and again. In fact, there is it's one consequence of it is just in case you've heard these funny words, there's something known as the Schouten identity, which is a statement of this form. Plus cyclic, so C A lambda B alpha plus B C lambda A alpha is equal to zero. Okay. And this statement simply reflects the fact that I can always take lambda C and expand it in terms of lambda B and lambda A. That's all. If you just write the formula lambda c equals some linear combination of lambda a and lambda b, that's exactly that identity. All right? So the fact that these are two-dimensional vectors is going to be very, very important constantly. But anyway, in this case, we don't even need to do something so fancy as that. Let's just take this equation and dot it into, let's say, lambda 1. Okay? If I dot it into lambda 1, Then from here I see that 1, 2, lambda tilde 2, plus 1, 3, lambda tilde 3, alpha dot, has got to equal 0. Okay. Similarly for the other ones. And similarly for an equation, if I replace these, if I replace, I just do it with the conjugate variables. Okay. Now let's look at this equation for a second. Let's say that 1, 2 is actually not equal to 0. Okay? If 1, 2 is not equal to 0, then 1, 3 it also better not equal to 0. Because otherwise we'd be setting lambda tilde 2 to 0. That's just zero momentum. We're trying to find generic momentum. So if 1, 2 is not equal to 0, then 1, 2 and 1, 3 are both not equal to 0. That's fine. But it means that lambda tilde 2 is proportional to lambda tilde 3. Okay. So you see that, and similarly, If we now apply this to the other equations, we find that if 1, 2, and 1, 3, and 2, 3, either they're not equal to 0, their angle brackets are all not equal to 0, but then all of the lambda tildes have to be proportional to each other, or the other way around. Okay. So there's only two ways of conserving momentum. Either all lambda tildes are proportional, which means that all the lambda tilde I and lambda tilde j vanish, and the lambda i's are generic, so ij are not equal to 0, or the other way around. Okay. That's extremely powerful. Go back for a sec, just coming back to the question, because this highlights the point. Coming back to the question, why the amplitude have to be zero in Yang-Mills. Phi cubed is special. The amplitude can just be a constant, right? In Yang-Mills, you know it can't be a constant. It's got to depend on momentum in some way, right? But what could it depend on? Are there analogs of S, T, and U for three particles? There are no analogs of S, T, and U, because P1 plus P2 is equal to P3, negative P3. So P1 plus P2 squared is 0. So P1 dot P2 is 0. All the PI dot PJ are 0. There's simply no Lorentz invariants. There are no Lorentz invariants you can build out of the momentum. The entire amplitude is pure polarization vector, if you like. Okay? All it depends on is helicity. Once you know it, there's no way of modifying it by multiplying by some random function of Lorentz invariants. Okay? And we're seeing that quite explicitly here. So we can now talk about this has a very powerful consequence, which is that the amplitude is either a function of angle brackets or a function of square brackets.
So how it would be, so if you get four?
We'll do four in a second. This is very special to three. You'll see the structure of the three-particle amplitude is completely nailed, non-perturbatively, period. There's one thing it can be, and we're going to write it down. Okay. Starting at four particles and above, it's not zero. No, we're going to write it down. It'll turn out to be zero for real momentum, but it's not in general zero. So let me write down the answer. You can trivially generalize it for any situation you want. But let me write down the answer in the particular case where all the particles have the same spin s, and only they have different helicities. Okay. So there's only two configurations: either two are plus and one are minus, or all are plus, and the other way around. So let's start off by talking about the case where, say, two of them are plus and one of them is minus, okay, and they all have spin s. Then this amplitude is the following. I have to tell you who 1, 2, and 3 are.
I'm going to get confused. You say spin and helicity. We are talking about
so spin. Particles of spin 1,
so we can
but they have velocity.
No.
The overall spin.
Huh? Only one.
No. Whatever the spin is, if it's a spin 1 particle, it can still have everything is massless here, right?
Yes.
Because if it's spin 1 particle, it can still have velocity plus 1 or minus 1.
Yes.
I'm just giving you the general formula for.
So what other spin they could have? You talk about
any spin. Any spin you want. Spin 2, spin 17, we're going to write down the formula for all of them.
All
okay?
Integer.
Huh? Sorry?
Integer.
Integer or
spin also.
So this is, huh?
Also for spin half?
Also for spin half, yes. For anything. Of course, there is no three-point function with all spin a half.
Yes.
Okay? And this is a nice way that you would discover it. I mean, I don't want to spend a long time on this, but playing with a three-point function and the four-point function, you can reconstruct every standard fact about quantum field theory, spin statistics, anti-particle, the whole shebang. The fact that Yang-Mills theory, spin one has got to be described by Yang-Mills, spin two has got to be described by gravity, there's no consistent higher spin theories. All of that stuff follows very powerfully and beautifully just by playing.
So here you assume that S can be everything?
But that's right. But here I'm just doing kinematics. I'm just writing down the possible objects that have the correct Lorentz transformation properties to be deserved to be called the three-point function for the particles. And I'm telling you, when all the spins are the same, it's 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the power of S. Okay. Let's see why that's the case. The important point here is that because of this fact, it can either be a function of the lambda tildes or a function of the lambdas, but not both. Okay. In particular, that reflects the following fact I should have mentioned earlier. When we talk about something like a standard Lorentz invariant, like P1.P2, what is P1.P2? P1.P2 is nothing other than 1, 2 times angle bracket 1, 2, squared angle bracket times 1, 2. Okay. See, that makes sense in this vanishing little group way.
Okay. Is that a factor of 2 or something?
There's a factor of 2, yes. 2 equals 1 in these lectures. I'm working mod mistakes. Okay. Yes, there's a 2, isn't there? But damn if I know where it is. Is it here?
Yes.
Probably there.
Yes.
Okay. There you go. I'm good. All right. Thank you. All right. So. Okay, so these are general Lorentz invariants. The Lorentz invariants we're used to, S, T, U, things like that, are products of spinner brackets like this with vanishing little group weight. And you see exactly what we saw before is manifesting itself. Because one or the other of these are zero, all of these sorts of objects are just zero here for three particles, for the special case of three particles. Okay. So that means that I can only build the invariant out of one kind of bracket or the other kind of bracket. Okay, so this is, so, and but that's it. Now the actual powers that can appear are completely fixed by getting the correct homogeneity under all the particles. See this funny cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3, this guarantees the net weight under 1 is, there's 3 ones upstairs and 1 downstairs, so it's the 2s upstairs, which is correct. So that's positive helicity. That tells us the particle one has positive helicity. Particle 2 has particle helicity, particle 3 has negative helicity. The general formula looks identical to something anyone who has looked at three-point functions in conformal field theory is familiar with. The general formula has, if you have S1, S2, S3, is 1, 2 to the S2 plus S3 minus S1, 2, 3 to the other way around, and so on. So you can work it out for yourself. But this is what it is in the general case. Now, you might have said, wait a minute, I could have written down something else. I could have written down 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the negative S. These have exactly the same weights. Okay. So those are the two allowed objects that you could have. Those are the two allowed objects that you could have. But we have one more physical requirement, which is that the amplitude should be smooth in the limit where the momenta become real. Okay? In the limit where the momenta become real, this goes to zero and that blows up. Okay? So we don't use this one. So that's the plus plus minus amplitude. What is the minus minus plus amplitude? Well, it's just exactly times some constant. Okay. Minus minus plus would be angle bracket 1, 2, 2 over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the power of s times some constant. And those are all the possible plus plus minus and minus minus, all the amplitudes with two particles of one velocity and one of the other. Let's pause here already and make a number of additional comments. First, this is a completely non-perturbative statement. Okay? There's no couple, I mean, this is just kinematically, can't be anything else. So three particle amplitudes are completely fixed by the Poincaré invariants. That's wonderful because we know in the Lagrangian, somehow the cubic vertices are the most important things. But in Lagrangians, they come along with quartic vertices and all sorts of other stuff, right? But when you're talking about the amplitudes, a dead invariant statement is that the three-point amplitude is completely fixed by Poincaré symmetry. Its structure is totally fixed by Poincaré symmetry. We can read off, yes?
When you talk about having these amplitudes for complex momenta, should I think of those as being defined by analytic continuation?
Absolutely.
But then if you start off on the roll the momenta real and everything is zero in analytic continuation way, why does it get zero?
Well, this is you see that all the functions we're talking about are actually meromorphic. They're not going to be pure analytic. So they have interesting pole structures, which is why you don't necessarily see them. So they're all defined, they're all analytic up to poles and branch cuts. Okay. Right. So and the poles and branch cuts are very important, but yeah. Okay. So you see the poles right here, right? Now, of course, when you uniformly go to zero momenta, there's more zero upstairs than downstairs, so it vanishes. But if you attempt to analytically continue in any one of the momenta, you would encounter some poles, and that would be fun. Okay. So, secondly, just the units of this object you can just read straight off, right? So, for example, if it's all spin 1, that coupling is dimensionless. If it's spin 2, the coupling is units of length squared, and so on. Third, notice something totally remarkable about this. For example, the statement, the famous statement that Henry made famous, that gravity is gauge squared, is completely obvious here. This is the one place where it's dead obvious and it hits you over the head. Okay? The three-point amplitude for gravity is literally the square of the three-point amplitude for spin 1. Period. Okay? Right. Now, notice, let's compare this to the Lagrangian. You stare at the Yang-Mills Lagrangian and the gravity Lagrangian, the cubic vertex of gravity has 80 terms in it, right? The statement is, if you took the Lagrangian, shoved in all the external polarization vectors, it would be gigantic cancellations in those 80 terms, and that's the answer you'd find. Okay? The Lagrangian is horribly obscuring this. Third, you can write down a three-point function for spin 100. There's no obstruction at the level of the three-point function to having higher spin theories. Okay? In fact, there's a cottage industry of people who spent years developing a sort of BRST-like formalism for writing down complicated nonlinear Lagrangians up the cubic order for massless higher spin theories. Just completely pointless. We know it's possible. This is the beauty of the talking about the amplitude. The amplitude doesn't have any off-shell gauge redundancies, any excess baggage. It's just the answer. Okay? You can write down the answer. It's consistent as Lorentz invariant, and everything is fine. So the fact that they succeeded after all these years to write down cubic Lagrangians that were consistent with their BRST stuff is not very impressive. We just derived that fact in one line. Okay? What's hard is the next stage in their grand program is to extend this to the quartic level. Okay, find a consistent quartic Lagrangian, and that's where all the difficulty begins, because you see, in this way of thinking about things, what we're making manifest from the get-go is the fact that amplitudes have the correct transformation properties. We're looking at them as they are, and so on. But then, if you want to then build some theory, you'd start having to imagine what a four-point function would look like. But let's actually do that. Before I move on to the four-point function and what's wrong with higher spin theories, let me just make another quick comment here, just to finish the story. What would the plus 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 amplitude look like?
Maybe zero.
No. That's 1, 2, that's even easier, 2, 3, 3, 1 to the power of s. Okay? Because this Garrett, so one, everybody appears upstairs twice, so that's the all plus amplitude, and the all minus amplitude is the same thing with angle brackets. Okay.
So can you repeat again where do I see the divergence if you were to use the other brackets with minus s?
Sorry?
If you were to write this one as the other bracket with the minus s,
That also has a divergence.
Right. How can you repeat how you see?
Yes. The reason is going to real momenta. Mm-hmm. You see, I should have mentioned this. here, what we saw is even for complex momenta, the lambdas that satisfy momentum conservation are a little bit singular, right? Not singular, but they're a little bit constrained. All the lambda tildes have got to be proportional, but the lambda's going to be generic, and the other way around. Okay? Or the other way around. Now, going to real momenta means that lambda tilde must be lambda star. So if all the lambdas are proportional, all the lambda tildes are also proportional. So real momentum in this language means that you're sending the angle brackets to zero and also the square brackets to zero. Okay. So that's why if I send all the square brackets here to zero, this thing vanishes. Well, there's two in the numerator, two in the denominator, but three in the numerator, so it vanishes. If I put the other way around, if I did with the angle brackets, 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3, to the power of negative s, then it would diverge.
Okay, here it would be one over.
So if for this amplitude I attempted this one, then I would also have a divergence. Okay? So I don't do that one. But of course, the all minus amplitude is 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 1 to the power of s. Now, you just look at these things, you see that they have different units than those do, right? In fact, what does this correspond to? That corresponds to writing down some trace f cubed term. It's a higher dimension operator. The higher dimension operator can give you this thing. Okay. Can give you that amplitude. You also learn that no matter what higher dimension operators write down, whatever the heck is going on, all the possible cubic terms you could write down with more and more derivatives on them, whatever you want, in the end, these are the two possible forms of the three-point function.
So
for example, in the case of gravity, you see that the first kind of correction you can have, the other kind of three-point function you have, this would come from an R cubed term. Okay? In fact, the two-loop counter term in gravity is exactly that. Okay? It's exactly giving you that structure for the scattering.
So can you think about having different spin or the mass?
Spin S1, S2, S3.
Yeah.
Yes, as I said, the formula would then, which I encourage you to work out, is that it would be just, it would be 1, 2 to the S1 plus S2 minus S3, 2, 3 to the da-da-da, and the other way around. Okay? So it has a very simple generalization. Okay. Okay, but this is just incredibly beautiful, right? You see that the three-point function is just a slave to Poincaré invariants. Can't be anything else. All right. Now let's briefly talk about the four-point function. See, so let's do a simple example. Let's say imagine we want to do a gravity scattering amplitude. Okay. So we have particles 1, 2, 3, and 4. Let me just tell you ahead of time what the answer must look like. That's the most general possible thing it can look like. I've pulled out this factor 1, 2, 3, 4 to the 4th. This now makes, these have the correct, make sure that 1, 2, 3, and 4 occur with the correct weights to interpret it as gravitons, massless gravitons of the appropriate helicities. Whatever's left has got to have vanishing little group weight, so it can only be a function of the actual Lorentz invariant kinematics, the standard ones, S, T, and U. So once again, in complete generality, you can write any four-point function by stripping off these trivial angle square bracket factors that take the helicities into account, multiplied by some function of S, T, and U. In this way, it's extremely easy to make ansatzes for possible scattering amplitudes. Three-points are nailed, four-point here's an ansatz, higher point we can make ansatzes. Okay? And you could
attempt. Gravity here? Huh?
How do you know it's gravity? The fact that it's gravity is that you read off from here, what is the homogeneity of this thing under rescaling particle 1? You discover if you rescale 1, it goes like t to the 4th. Therefore, it has helicity 4 times a half, which is 2. So the formula is telling you what's involved. It's telling you it's two particles of helicity plus 2 and two particles of helicity minus 2. Okay?
You can raise that.
Yeah.
If you raise that to the power of 2 instead, would that be a spin?
That would be spin 1. That's right. Absolutely. you can raise it to the power of 97. See, it's Maxime's place. That's right. Yes. Yes, you can raise it to the power of 98 as well. Yeah.
The question is, the fourth point is, besides the invariance S, T, U, you need to worry about the anti-symmetric tensor contracting with all the momentum.
Do you need to worry about the anti-symmetric tensor contracting with
because
all the
momentum? Because it already has four momentum. It's also not the invariant.
That's true. So here for the moment, I'm assuming parity. Okay,
yes.
Just to make my life a little bit easier. You're right. There's one other object that I can do. Let's thank you. Now you can do the following exercise. But now there are physical requirements. Okay. A physical requirement is that the poles of this four-particle amplitude have to have a particular physical interpretation. Okay? If there are poles. If there's any pole in S, P, or U, then let's say there's a pole in S, it has to be of the form 1 over S, okay? And the residue of that pole has to be the product of two lower three-point amplitudes, okay? That's a statement that the pole is reflecting the physical process in space-time, right? Poles should have the physical interpretation of something taking place over a long distance in space-time. So this is the famous factorization properties, even at the, let's just say we're talking about tree level now. For the three-point function, even the word tree level didn't make an appearance. Let's imagine in some lowest order approximation, we're talking about scattering up to some lowest order approximation, this is the sort of factorization property that they need to have. Okay? So that's now a constraint on what those functions of S, T, and U can look like. And now you can do the following exercise. I think the exercise, now occurs in Tony Z's quantum field theory book in the second edition. So I'll just quote what the exercise is. Put in arbitrary spins there. Let's say, for simplicity, we're doing all the same spin. But put in the requirement, put in this requirement, that if it has a pole, then it has to factorize in this way. And we know what the lower particle amplitudes are, right? We know what the three-point amplitudes are. Here you have to sum over all the helicities that could run in the middle. There's plus, there's a minus there. There's a minus, there's a plus there. Okay? But summing over all those helicities, you should get, it should factorize appropriately. What you find, if you're talking about a single spin S particle, is that there's two solutions, S equals 0 and S equals 2. And that's it. Everything else is just impossible. It's impossible to find a function F, S, C, and U that factorizes properly. Very simple exercise. I don't have time to go through it now, but it's a very simple exercise. This is how you discover that the only consistent theories of a single self-interacting massless spin S particle is either phi cube theory or gravity. Okay. What about spin one? Well, remember that was for a single spin S particle. So if we allow ourselves to have cubic interactions with three-point couplings with many different species of particles, then I can put in an A, B, and a C. So I have 1, 2, for example, if this is minus, minus, plus, I have 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3. Let's say I'm doing spin 1. Times some coupling that I can call FABC.
Sorry, what is STU? I missed that.
STU are the Lorentz invariant, like P1 dot P2.
Okay, so those ones.
P1 dot P3. P1 dot P4.
But you said that S can be either 0 or 2. It's not
that. Oh, it's not that. I'm sorry. It's a spin of the particle. It's not that. So if we call this, let's call it just some constant K, C, just so we don't prejudice ourselves. You find if you go through exactly the same exercise, now this F would have to have four indices on it and so on. You find that F has got to be made out of the square of something, the square of the K's, and it's only consistent with the K's satisfied the Jacobi identity. Okay, so you discover that the only consistent interactions are Yang-Mills. This is all the same as the content of Weinberg's theorem, that the only consistent massless spin one particles are Yang moles, massless spin two particles are gravity. But the logical structure of the argument is very different, and actually the result is much more direct. And you get the answer much, much more quickly. And the reason, the actual arguments are different, because their starting points are totally different. See, Weinberg more or less starts with some underlying picture of a Lagrangian, even though it's said to be some S-matrix argument. He's really imagining drawing Feynman diagrams and talking about soft limits, and demanding precisely that when you replace a polarization vector by P mu and dot it into the amplitude and the soft limit, it vanishes. Okay? That's a very strong constraint that he uses to establish that GR is the only theory of massless spin 2, Yang moles per massless spin 1. Our starting point in these arguments is totally different. We're guaranteed to be dealing with objects with the correct Lorentz transformation properties. We don't have to impose it at the end. We start from that, but because we don't even have an underlying picture of Feynman diagrams in mind, the thing that we have to check is things like unitarity, factorization, and so on, which is the check that we do. Okay? Of course, you arrive at the same result.
I don't understand. What does factorization, why do you impose factorization? I mean, how do you know that they have to fulfill that property?
Purely from the point of view of formalism, in the sense of writing down objects with the correct Lorentz transformation properties, they don't.
Right.
But there's more to physics than group theory.
Right.
Okay? And these factorization properties are what telling you, or what encoding that there is locality in space-time. Okay? It's telling you that there's really some underlying local physics here. Even though we're not talking about Lagrangians or anything like that, the underlying local physics is reflected in very particular sorts of factorization properties of the amplitude.
Yes, so don't you have to go through some Lagrangian or Feynman diagrams to get that locality
argument? No, I mean, you can rather say it the other way around. Mm-hmm. You can say that for theories that have these nice factorization properties, if someone handed you an amplitude like that, you would look at it, you'd notice something very interesting happens. It has poles, but the poles don't have random interpretations. The poles look always like 1 over p squared. You can imagine Fourier transforming that in your mind and realizing that it corresponds to a singularity along the light cone. Okay? And furthermore, that the residues of those poles are the product of two lower point things. So that's allowing you to reconstruct the picture in space-time. Something happening over there, propagating for a long time on the light cone and making something go on over there. Being just slightly off-shell and getting a singularity as it goes exactly on shell.
I'm a little confused, because it seems like we are imposing locality here.
Of course, at the moment we're just learning to talk about amplitudes in this other language. Okay?
So at this point it doesn't emerge.
No, absolutely not. I'm telling you how to look for it, though. This is very nice. If someone hands you a bunch of functions like this, they all have the correct Lorentz transformation properties. How do you know whether they're just crapping something or it's corresponding to a local theory? Well, there are things that you can check. You hunt around for its poles, and you see if its poles have a good interpretation. At higher orders, there's not just poles, there's branch cuts, there's more things that you have to take into account. But the poles and discontinuities have always physical interpretations related to lower point processes. Okay? So that's how locality and unitarity are imprinted onto these objects. When we play with Feynman diagrams and polarization vectors and redundancy, those things are built in. The unitarity and the locality are built in. We suffer, on the other hand, we never see the object, right? We're always giving them these redundant representations, so we never see the objects. So it's just a sort of orthogonal starting point for thinking about all of these things.
What happened to fermions?
Oh, you see, in this entire argument, I was assuming that we're all only talking about interactions between all three spin S particles, which you can't do if it's three fermions. That's actually a way of discovering that you can't do because you get these fractional powers of the angle square square methods. But that'll take me a little too long to explain.
But you're saying it's really like the 1960s, the old S-matrix approach.
Right.
No Lagrangian, no field theory.
That's right. Except as I said yesterday. Some of the philosophy sounds the same, but there's one very critical difference, which is that, I'm just repeating something I said yesterday, but there's two critical differences. one sort of practical and one, well, not, well, one more philosophical than the other. The one that's sort of practical is that the 60s people, from our point of view now, were working on the hardest possible theory to give an S-matrix description for. A theory of scalars, which already suck and are massive, which suck even more. Okay. What they should have been doing, had they been playing with the S-matrix of Yang-Mills theory of gravity, they might have gotten a lot further. Okay. A. But B, their basic attitude was that they're going to impose causality and unitarity and locality and get the answer uniquely out of it. Right? An attitude that seems absurd today, because we know we can write any one of 10 to the 500 Lagrangians, or more, and those Lagrangians are unitary, wonderful, Lorentz invariant, causal theories. So it's ridiculous to think that you're going to get a unique answer out of that. The attitude instead is that we're still going to try to eviscerate the local space-time description, but we're going to look for other principles. It's not going to be just unique out of the blue. We're going to have to find some theory, find some principles that tell us what to do, and have the causality and the locality unitarity emerge out of that. Right. So it isn't. They wanted to assume that you're just going to impose these things, and we want to see that they're coming out. Not only do not impose them, they're so unimportant. They're just ancillary consequences of some secondary starting point. That and, of course, the fact that we actually got somewhere. So, and there's a variety of other differences, by the way, important technical differences. They were very obsessed with 2-to-2 scattering, and in 2-to-2 scattering, it pays to quickly complexify not the momenta but the Mandelstam invariants, S, T, and U. So what they did is talk about extending the functions in the complex STU plane and so on and so forth. Here, we're actually complexifying the momenta directly. It makes a very big difference, especially as you go to a higher particle. So there's also a variety of technical differences. Okay. So you've seen the three-point function. You've seen some four-point functions. That's what should we now talk about. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's an infinite class of two-point functions that of n-point functions in Yang-Mills that in just pure Yang-Mills that we can talk about, where particles I and j have negative velocity and everyone else has positive velocity. Oh, I should have said. It turns out, and we'll understand in a moment why, that the all plus scattering amplitude and the all plus or 1 minus scattering amplitude are equal to 0. And if you have two of them that are non-zero, this amplitude in Yang-Mills is this beautiful formula that we've written down already a number of times. And again,
Definitely yeah. Written for real momenta is 0.
For everything.
But for real the 3 complex. One, it was not 0.
Huh? No. This is in Yang-Mills now. For all plus, or all plus, and remember,
yeah, for
it was possible to write down couplings with all plus that weren't zero, but they had different units. That you don't get them from pure Yang-Mills. You get them if you have some trace F cubed coupling. But if you don't have trace F cubed, you don't have them. Okay. So the all plus amplitude really just vanishes in pure Yang-Mills. Right.
So this is,
yeah.
But let me try to be very precise. What the extra ingredients you're putting in.
So here, now I'm talking about scattering amplitudes in Yang-Mills. Standard Yang-Mills, two derivatives, no higher dimension operators, nothing but standard Yang-Mills. Okay. Not in the super Yang-Mills yet.
Yeah. So what?
No super Yang-Mills.
The assumption is that
your Lagrangian is.
Sorry, pure Yang-Mills is a three-level statement. Sorry? Pure Yang-Mills is a three-level statement. These are all three-level statements, of course. So. This is a tree level statement. Obviously, I'm running out of amplitude here.
So the statement is that you use only x squared terms. So that's something you kind of use Lagrangian here.
Well, no, because Well, we could spend all day talking about this this philosophy back and forth, with or without Lagrangians. I mean, I'll be happy to spend a huge amount of time on it. But after a little while, it gets boring. But let me do one more. Okay? You could say, yes, I take it from the Lagrangian, or you could have another attitude that you say, look, the cubic couplings are nailed by Poincaré invariants. Is it possible for me to build a theory that's completely nailed by Poincaré invariants, entirely nailed by it? So all I do is put in the information about the three-point coupling, go. I want to find the theory where all the 400 or 500 point functions, all of its properties are completely determined by that of the three-point function. Is that possible? It's very constraining, because the four-point function has to have the correct factorization properties and relate them to the three-point function. Okay, once you've got the four-point function, you move to the five-point function. Can you do that? Okay, can you proceed in that way? In this way, in place of the Lagrangian, the seed that you're putting in is the three-point vertex. Okay? That's a much better seed, because that seed is completely nailed by Poincaré symmetry. Okay. Now, we could decide, are you putting in both kinds of three-point vertex, only one kind of three-point vertex? Okay. And here we're putting the lowest dimension three-point vertex.
Okay.
Okay. So if we do that, then
so you can start from the.
That's right. You can just start starting.
Things
right.
From the.
And of course, you can translate all of this to Lagrangian language. Okay, but these are just equivalent. You know, everything at this level is equivalent. It's just a question of looking at it from very complementary point of view. But of course, you can translate everything back and forth. Yes.
Is that MHV0 the real momentum is 3-1, or is that more general?
Sorry?
That's zero?
That's zero for all. So let me make this statement more precise. So let's say we look at this amplitude of all plus, or all plus and one minus. Okay? In Yang-Mills theory, ordinary Yang-Mills theory, this is zero at tree level. In super Yang-Mills, it's actually zero, period.
And, this
and it's true for any momentum.
Any momentum.
It's true for any momentum. Yes?
So the three-point moment that you wrote down as an example of one minus and two plus.
The three-point...
Even the dimension is one.
That's right. And, right. So this is for everything higher than 3 points.
Okay.
It's for everything higher than 3 points. In fact, the statement that it's zero is that it is zero for generic momenta in anything higher than the three part of amplitude is a special case. The three part of amplitude is special because it's not quite non-zero for completely generic lambdas and lambda tildes. Well, there are no completely generic lambdas and lambda tildes. They have to satisfy momentum conservation. Okay. But yes, this is for everything higher than the three-point function. This is a 3.6. So for any momentum.
So I mean, this thing is.
Yeah.
So if I have Yang-Mills, this is not true at loop level,
right? At loop level, it's not true, but it's true at tree level.
Okay. So right now, everything we're doing is tree level.
At the moment, now everything I'm doing is tree level. Okay.
To prove this, you need something in addition to scaling, which is how many powers of momentum.
To prove the statement, to prove the fact that it's zero, it's a direct consequence of supersymmetry, which we'll see in just a moment. But it's not a detailed statement. It's just
it's not a consequence of just that scaling.
No. It's definitely not a consequence of just the scaling. No, absolutely not. Okay, I'm just writing this down as so here's yet another example. Here's an infinite class of amplitudes that we know. Okay. All right, and you can easily see that it has the correct. Now let's talk about super amplitudes. Now we're talking about super amplitudes. And we're going to be talking about maximal supersymmetry. And this is yet another example of how much more invariant the amplitudes are as a way of talking about physics than the Lagrangian. Okay. But I actually want to motivate why, even if you've never heard of supersymmetry, you'd be led to thinking about inventing it. The maximal versions, n equals 4 and n equals 8, thinking along these lines. You see, so now we have these beautiful amplitudes. They are labeled by helicities. They depend on momenta, or lambdas and lambda tilde. So they're functions of helicity, lambda and lambda tilde, normally. But it's actually, it's very annoying because they're labeled by this discrete series of plus ones and minus ones, depending on the helicities of the external particles. It's very choppy. Okay, it's very discrete. For n particles, there's 2 to the n different amplitudes that you could be keeping track of here. Okay. And there's So if you want to do anything, you know, if you want to write down a formula here, like in this factorization formula, you're always summing over these helicities. Okay, so there's these discrete sums all over the place. And in general, we don't like discrete things so much. It would be great to be able to do all of this in a much more smooth and continuous way. It would be nice if the functions weren't functions of 2 smooth variables and 1 discontinuous discrete variable. But that's actually exactly what maximal supersymmetry allows you to do. And it's actually a special thing of maximal supersymmetry. It's not true for n equals 2, or for gravity, it's not true for n equals 7 or n equals 6. N equals 4 and n equals 8 are special. And the reason is that n equals 4, maximal supersymmetry, puts all the spins in one multiply. That's not true for any lower supersymmetry. Okay. But if you start with a negative helicity gluon, you can act on it with 4 supercharges. So I have the Qs, the Q tildes. There's 4 of them. So I runs from 1 to 4 because it's n equals 4 or 8. So in general, we say that it runs from 1 to script n for the number of supersymmetries. But if it's maximal, if n equals 4 or 8, then I can start from a negative helicity gluon, and I can go, there's 1 of those, there's 4 states, there's 4 Gaginos, there's 6 scalars, 4 of the other Gagino of the opposite helicity, and 1 positive helicity gluon. Okay, so negative 1, negative 1/2, 0, 1/2, 1. But importantly, everyone is the same multiplet together. Okay? So that means that there's actually a better way of labeling the amplitudes, not as a function of h lambda and lambda tilde. Okay? In other words, instead of using helicity states as the external states, it's better to use something that makes the action of the supersymmetry a lot more manifest. So we do that by using Grassmann coherent states. These are just things that are, if you like, you have the supersymmetry algebra. Why do we label things by momenta to begin with? We want to diagonalize as much of the Poincaré group as we can. So we use momenta. They all commute. Just do as much as you can. Okay? So we can also diagonalize some of the Qs. We can't diagonalize both of the Qs and the Q tildes, because they don't commute. But choose one of them. Choose the Qs, say. I can choose to diagonalize the Q, to make the action of Q manifest. So I can choose the label, which I'll call eta, but this is going to be lambda alpha acting on eta, oh sorry, lambda alpha eta I acting on eta lambda tilde. I have to get the alpha index to be somewhere. It's coming from the lambda. So that's what the state is, and I can write it explicitly as eta lambda tilde is e to the q bar lambda tilde acting on the negative helicity gluons.
So Nima, the point is to make eta continuous or?
Yeah, so eta is now a continuous but Grassmann parameter. Okay.
Continuous Grassmann?
I mean, it is a Grassmann parameter. But we're going to integrate over it, we're, you know, just as usual in SUSY, we treat it totally symmetrically with the other variables. It's just Grassmann. So this is equal to, so let me be a little more precise. So there's a Q tilde alpha dot I, oops, eta I, and actually the object here is what I might call W alpha dot, where W alpha dot satisfies the W lambda tilde, W tilde lambda tilde is equal to 1. But anyway, if you expand this out, what you get is, so this state eta lambda lambda tilde is literally like a particular linear combination of all of these helicity states. So it's literally the negative gluon state lambda lambda tilde plus eta I times the negative a half lambda lambda tilde, but there's four of these, which so there's an I index on there. Plus 1 over 2 factorial eta I eta j times the 0 scalars lambda lambda tilde. There are 6 of those, which are an antisymmetric tensor I and j, plus the other one. Okay. So it's literally some linear combination of the external helicity states on which SUSY acts nicely. Yes?
You might find a minute before I have the other.
Sure, sure. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so. Great, so now we have a choice for any state, we have a choice whether to label things by eigenstates of Q or eigenstates of Q tilde. Okay. So in general we could talk about amplitudes which are a function of now A, lambda tilde A, or something different, which is to label it by eta tilde A. Lambda A, lambda tilde A. I can do whichever I like. I can go from this to that representation just by Fourier transforming the eta variables. Right? It's just like going diagonalizing Q versus diagonalizing Q, Q tilde. So just Fourier transforming eta or eta tilde relates me from one representation to the other representation. Now, here's just a very beautiful thing. The action of n equals 4 supersymmetry is completely well-defined on these amplitudes, on those states. I know exactly what n equals 4 does, right? Well, it's just trivial. I know exactly what q's do to it. Any supersymmetry transformation, everything is totally manifest. This is an on-shell n equals 4 supersymmetry, and it's totally well-defined. Contrast it with off-shell n equals 4 supersymmetry that no one has found a way of writing n equals 4 that makes that manifest. In fact, this is, as I said, it's one of the interesting things about supersymmetry, something that certainly bugs all grad students, certainly bugged me when they first learned it, is whether or not a theory has supersymmetry seems to depend on the cleverness of the theorist. It isn't a property of the theory. It's a property of the theorist to see if the theorist was smart enough to find the correct off-shell degrees of freedom auxiliary fields to add in to be able to see the supersymmetry. Even if you forget the auxiliary fields, if we just talk about integrate out all the auxiliary fields, the point is that what the supersymmetry transformations are depends on the Lagrangian. That's not true for other normal global symmetries. Like a U1 symmetry is delta phi is I phi for every theory. Doesn't matter what the Lagrangian is. What the symmetry is it is what it is. Not so for supersymmetry. Supersymmetry depends on the theory. Okay? So it depends on the cleverness of the theorist, whether or not it has the symmetry. I think this is another hint that there's something wrong with the off-shell way of thinking about things. Especially so because this most beautiful and symmetric theory that we have, for Yang-Nose theory, there is no Lagrangian for it. There's no Lagrangian that makes all of its symmetries totally manifest. But the actual symmetries, the actual full n equals 4 symmetry, acting on the physical object, the scattering amplitude, is trivial. There it is. Using these variables, we make it totally trivial. Okay. So for n equals a, it's exactly the same thing. For n equals a, it's exactly the same thing. I mean, I've never seen the n equals 8 Lagrangian in my life. I mean, I can't bear flipping through so many pages. But it's possible to work on n equals 8 scattering amplitudes, no problem. I mean, I've written papers on n equals 8 because it's really easy. The supersymmetry is really easy. Yeah? And not only is it really easy, it's easier than other theories because now we don't have to drag these plus and minus indices around. The amplitudes are just beautiful, smooth functions of the Grassmann variable, of Grassmann and bosonic variables. For example, if I want to go back, instead of doing a helicity sum, what do you think I do? Well, if there's an eta there, I put an eta there and I just do integral e for eta. So I'm doing the angles. That's it. That does the helicity sum.
Can you write-hand how to do it where you're transforming Grassmann space?
Well, it's just integral e to the... So, integrals are way easier for Grassmann integrals than for ordinary integrals, right? That, because they're the same as derivatives. But you just follow the rule that integral d eta is 1, and you just do it. Everything truncates. So I write these as these exponentials just to remind me that they're what they are, but they truncate. Okay, so this is the object of interest. And so let me end by writing the supersymmetric version of that. So perhaps I can just say one thing very, very briefly. So what does supersymmetry do? Well, let me say it in words. A Q supersymmetry transformation, let's say on these guys, because the eta's are eigenstates of Q, a Q supersymmetry transformation just multiplies this by an overall factor. What overall factor does it multiply it by? It multiplies it by e to the lambda eta, right? So a Q Suzy acts on this. If I act on this with e to the zeta Q, okay, I end up getting an overall factor which is e to the power of zeta times the sum over a of lambda a a to a. Okay? Because Q is an eigenstate. Okay. So, I think, well, all right. So you see that in order for this to be invariant under Suzy, it had better be that the amplitude has a delta function of that factor in it. It's exactly like the argument for translation. When you do a translation, you get e to the I, the translation A, or D, times the sum over all the momenta. That's what the amplitude is multiplied by. The only way it can be invariant is if the amplitude is a delta function of that guy sitting in front of it. Okay? So similarly, we should expect to find the delta of the sum over A, lambda A, A to A, in front of everybody. Okay? All right? The other Suzy's, what do the other Suzy's do? The Q tilde Suzy's shift eta. Okay. So if I multiply e to the Q tilde zeta tilde here, it's clearly just going to commute through here, the Q tilde's commute, and it just shifts the eta. Okay. So that's what Suzy's do. They rephase and they shift. And using these facts, it's incredibly simple to prove these statements, just as a simple application. How would I, for instance, get the amplitude with all plus? Okay. To get the amplitude with all plus, I have to take m, and I just have to integrate d4 a to 1 up to d4 a to n of m of a to 1 up to a to n. Okay. All of these integrals pick out the eta to the fourth components, okay, which are the plus helicity amplitude. Because I started with minus helicity, so the eta to the fourth components forced me to pick up plus helicity. Now, it's very easy to see that this has to vanish. The simple argument is that using the Q tilde Suzy's, I have four supercharges, right? But I also have two directions, zeta tilde, right? I'm doing e to the zeta tilde alpha dot q tilde alpha dot I. So I have two of these zeta tildes. So I can use these SUSEs to actually send two ETAs to anywhere I like. I can translate them to anywhere I like. In particular, I can use them to translate them to the origin. Actually, for this argument, I can send two of them to the origin. So let's say I do that. I use my two SUSEs to translate two of these ETAs to the origin. Okay, but if I translate them to the origin, this integral manifestly vanishes because it doesn't depend on the two guys that I translated, so it's just zero by the Grassmann integration. Similarly, for the case with one of them being minus, I just get rid of one of these. Say, once again though, I can translate two of them to zero. I can still remove one of them, send them to the origin. One of the integrals gives me zero, and it's still zero. Okay. So we have to have at least two negative helicity particles and positive helicity for the other argument. Okay.
You really have to go on.
Yes. All right. So, So finally, then, this is what this Clark-Taylor amplitude looks like. It has a delta 8 of the sum over A, lambda A, eta tilde A, delta 4 of the sum over A, lambda tilde A. These are the momentum, the super momentum conserving delta functions. And the rest of this is 1, 2, 2, 3, up to N1. So that's the super Clark-Taylor amplitude. I should say, the supersymmetric statement is if you take lambda, eta, and eta tilde, sorry, lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. But if you take m of t lambda, t inverse lambda tilde, and t inverse eta tilde, is just equal to t to the minus 2 m of lambda, lambda, and eta tilde. So again, there's no helicities anymore, plus and minus or anything, but you've got to rescale the eta variable. Okay. So that's the supersymmetric version of Clark's dark tail. Okay, so I think we got all the kinematics taken care of today, and tomorrow, I will talk about the. This is the kinematics that takes care of Poincaré symmetry and super Poincaré symmetry. And tomorrow I'll extend it by talking about the nicest kinematic way of talking about the full conformal transformations, the super conformal transformations. That'll motivate the introduction of CRISPR variables, and the analog of this conformal symmetry on the dual side will motivate the introduction of the momentum CRISPR variables. So we'll talk about CRISPRs and momentum CRISPRs, and then we'll be able to, with all the groundwork set, we'll be able to get going with the mindset. All right, thanks a lot.